Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee is called to order. Today's Monday, May 3rd, 2021. The time is 1:32. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Myers, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Senator Holland. We have a quorum to conduct business today, just barely. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Carson, our moderator for the day. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones if you have them on board. So first on the agenda is Senate Joint Resolution number 7, a proposed constitutional amendment related to voter approval of taxes. And Mr. Barnhill, if you can hear me. Oh, Mr. Barnhill, I expect to see you on the screen. Didn't recognize you with your mask on. We didn't leave you much time on Friday. Please put yourself on the record and continue your presentation or any comments you may want to offer regarding SJR 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Barnhill. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. We did actually, Mr. Chair, get through all of the slides. It sounded like there was interest in having an in-depth legal discussion and questions from perhaps Senator Keel and others, and I'm happy to engage in the discussion and attempt to answer as many questions as I can. To the extent I can't, I believe Mr. Milks is also online and available.
Well, welcome to Senator Hughes. Thank you for joining the committee. And are there any remaining questions from the committee regarding SJR 7? I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, let me just pitch a softball, if I may.
Go for it.
We heard some interesting public testimony on this resolution, and a couple of different sort of theories about this what this does in terms of the structure of government. And interestingly, if I remember right, we both heard that this enhances a Republican form of democracy, small r, and that it enhances a direct democracy, sort of a plebeian form of democracy. In my observation, it enhances one and enhances the other depending on which outcome you want. So I thought I would ask the Deputy Commissioner, what is the vision of democracy contained in this change to our Constitution?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I had a phrase on Friday I didn't get to use, but I'll use it now. It creates what I would call a constitutional symmetry with respect to enacting new taxes between direct democracy and representative democracy. So both are involved when it comes to the enactment of new taxes. I hesitate to use the word enhance, because we have both in our Constitution now. But in this particular case, we're requiring both for this particular topic, enactment of new taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, my observation would be that it really just sort of tilts the field against new taxes rather than having a consistent philosophy. I did have a question about what constitutes a new tax under this language, the term is not defined here. And so I wonder about the sort of the constitutional interpretation. If we were to delete a tax break, is that a new tax?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So let's just level set on how we define constitutional terms. So the Alaska Supreme Court starts with dictionary definitions. And if those don't serve, then they'll look into legislative history, the content of these hearings. New here, I think, is going to mean new. Senator Schauer kind of put his finger on the crux of the matter on Friday, and that is we're looking at new taxes that we don't have right now, like a new sales tax, a new personal income tax, value-added tax. We don't have that on the books, gross receipt tax, things like that. That's really what this provision is getting after. And if you could rephrase your specific question, I will attempt to address that one directly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the word new isn't here, right? Establishes a tax. I should have been precise. My apologies for taking us down the wrong path there. So the question is, we could come up with any number of examples. We exempt natural gas for use in state from Cook Inlet from any taxation. Right, and that's a $100-125 million investment in affordable power for the Anchorage Bowl and Kenai Peninsula. What if we decided that we weren't going to make that investment and we deleted that exemption?
Okay.
Are we establishing a tax under this enactment?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Killick, that's a good question. Deleting exemptions. And I believe we were asked that question last year, and Mr. Milks wrote a letter, which was in the record, and we can put that letter back in the record, but I believe the response was that deleting exemptions would not constitute a new tax. I have the letter in my file, and I can refer to it more specifically, but probably best to punt at this point to Mr. Milks.
I don't know if Mr. Milks is listening in right now. Oh, there he is. Mr. Milks, if you care to comment on this, feel free to state your name, put yourself on the record, and provide any testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Bill Milks from the Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think Mr. Barnhill has started to explain a little bit about how terms are interpreted in the Constitution. And we've had a number of cases, including recent cases, where Alaska's report just sort of says, first we look at the plain text of the Constitution and the provision. How does it read? How would an ordinary, reasonable, practical understanding of those words, what would they mean? And that's important because it's the voters ultimately that are approving the constitutional amendment. Then it also looked at the drafting history as the amendment went through the various committees. How did it change? Or does the wording change? As well as Mr. Barnhill said, dictionary definition, as well as they might refer to other definition, other uses of the words in the Constitution. So this amendment, SJR 7, is somewhat different than the ones proposed previously 2 years ago and 1 year ago. So the specific language here establishes a state tax. So with that language, I mean, my thought on that is removing an exemption is not establishing a new state tax. So I don't think that would cover it. But like with all of these questions on a constitutional amendments, if legislators through this committee or other committee choose to modify the language in the amendment in different ways, then that is certainly important to the to an ultimate determination. But right now, we'd have the word establish a state tax. And so I think that one would be if you're creating a new tax.
Mr. Chair, I've now found the letter. And just for the record, it was dated April 15th, 2019, in response to Senator Hughes's question. It's authored by Mr. Milks. Happy to leave a copy for the committee. The response is, as stated in hearing testimony, the administration's intent is that changes to deductions, credits, and exemptions from an existing state tax would not be considered an increase in the rate of an existing state tax and thus would not require voter approval. Now, Senator Keel's question is, would that be construed as a new tax? You didn't ask if it would be an increase, but I think the response would be the same.
Thank you. Senator Keel, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a great conversation, very helpful. So if removing an exemption from an existing tax does not establish a new tax, even though it expands the universe of what is taxable, what about other expansions of the universe of what is taxable? We currently have a corporate income tax that applies only to C corporations. If we were to legislatively or the people by initiative expand that to S-corps and LLCs, other entities that hold a business license, would that establish a new tax?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, also a good question. And I believe there's a court case on that very issue from Colorado, and the holding of that case escapes me. at the moment, but we can certainly provide that. Of course, just because the Colorado Supreme Court finds a certain way in Colorado doesn't mean that courts would find the same here. I think for today what I can do is tell you I'm pretty sure there's precedent in other states on that. We'll provide that, and then Mr. Milks may also have some thoughts for you.
Mr. Milks?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Keough. Sheriff, I have many more thoughts other than what Mr. Barnhill expressed, other than sort of returning to the tools that a court would use. They'd be looking at what's the language, what's the a dictionary definition would probably, the Alaska Supreme Court would probably look at if this language stayed exactly the same, because the word tax is used in the Constitution right now, and when it had a meaning and a dictionary definition that the court has looked at when the framers adopted the Constitution, so they look at that. They would look at a variety of tools, including conversation at this table on what was the thoughts of the committee, and they've heard Mr. Barnhill's response. Does the language change as this amendment proceeds or not? So I don't disagree with what Mr. Barnhill said. I guess I'm just indicating that there'll be a much fuller record if there was ever a dispute before a court.
Last one on this line.
Okay, I was going to open up to other members. I don't want it to be the Senator Keel and Mike Barnhill meeting, but
it's fine. We
feel free.
That.
Go ahead.
It looks like I'm batting two for two with Mr. Milk, so let's see if he can get a strike through here.
Senator Keel.
The indulgence, Mr. Chairman. So the last one along the same lines, and it would be fascinating to go back over some of those letters and get further follow-up from the administration. But the last one would be how do you see what we like to term user fees, but I don't know that term has a constitutional definition. How do you see them falling within this framework for establishing a tax? User fees treated differently, and if so, does it matter whether they recover more than the cost of administering the program?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, another great question. And the distinction between a user fee and a tax is the subject of lots and lots of tax cases around the country. It's the administration's intent that user fees not be encompassed within the term tax for purposes of this amendment. Let me just give an additional clarification on what we think user fees encompasses. A user fee is a charge assessed by a state agency to defray the costs of providing a particular service to a member of the public. A great example would be a driver's license. And so if there was a change or the institution of a new user fee like a driver's license, that would not require voter approval. Now, Senator Keel just asked a harder question, and that is, what if the user fee recovers more than the cost of providing that particular service? And I believe that also has, there's a precedent from the Colorado Supreme Court on that very issue. Again, same caveat, that's Colorado, it's not Alaska. It's an interesting question. I can't say that it's gonna be helpful for me to predict what the courts would do there. I think the most important thing that I can say is that the intent of the administration here is not to characterize or interpret a user fee that's for the purpose of defraying costs of providing a particular service as a tax that would require voter approval.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Thank you, Senator Keel. And I'll offer it up. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Hughes?
Hey, this is going to seem like an odd one coming from me because I'm not a fan of taxes particularly, but there's something in here I'm not sure how it would work practically, and that's if the voters through an initiative process, establish a new tax. Then the legislature has to meet in joint session, either to approve it or reject it, or they could choose just not to meet, and it would be rejected, which would mean that it would fall, could fall on the shoulders of one presiding officer who doesn't want to meet in joint session. I don't know that that, I mean, there'd be a lot of political pressure, but I'm just saying I'm not sure structurally and practically how well that would work. So I'm on page 2, lines 6 through 13, part C there, because, you know, it unless it's the legislature approves it, then it says if the ledger fails to approve it, then it's rejected, but they could just not meet and it would never be approved. Am I reading something in there that's not there? But couldn't a single presiding officer who would refuse to meet in joint session basically reject an initiative by the voters?
So through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think what you're describing last session I referred to as a form of pocket legislative veto. Is that a fair characterization? In other words, this language requires approval by the legislature by majority vote. Failing that, it doesn't take effect. It doesn't appear that there's any prohibition against the pocket veto like you described. But Mr. Milks may have some other thoughts.
Mr. Milks?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Bill Milks again for the Department of Law. Senator Hughes, I think you, at page 2, lines 11 through 13, you accurately described what the amendment says. It's closing the loop there and telling exactly what's the consequence if there's if the legislature fails to act, which is that the law is rejected. And the particular question about the authority of a single presiding officer, that puts you back into the legislature's rules of procedure, which, of course, the legislature can always change its rules of procedure if it wants to. And so that's sort of a good practical observation I think you've made, but the language is clear here in telling us what's the consequence of a failure to act.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senator Hughes brings up a good point, and it strikes me as a case that just got resolved in the Supreme Court, 2 weeks ago or something along those lines. Talking about not holding a joint session in terms of confirming the governor's nominees for various positions. And it does concern me a little bit, and it makes me think that maybe we should change that particular language so that we can the legislature still approves by resolution, but instead of doing it by majority vote in joint session, we simply go through the normal process of approving a resolution of it going through each body, and we should be able to do that. And I think that may be a better process of what we go through here, because then while a particular presiding officer could in theory still slow it down or possibly even block it, it would become a little bit harder, and I think we might be able to get legislators more on record rather than simply letting one person stop any official action from being taken. I'd like to hear your response to that from either of you gentlemen.
Through the chat, I'm just going to pass on this one.
Mr. Milks, Mr. Barnhill has admitted he passes on this one. Do you have any comments on it?
Chairman, my comment to the chair, to the senator, and Bill Milks, that's a good observation. And that's a policy call for the legislature to make as it considers the proposed amendment. Right now, it is setting an outcome. It's clear. You know, sort of ambiguity existed in the case that you mentioned.
Mr. Milks, I'm going to ask you, it's like you're breaking up a little bit. And if you just restart this comment and maybe get a little closer to the mic, or if there's anything blocking your mic.
Thank you, Chairman. Again, I think this senator made a good observation on a policy decision, but I don't have any comments on a legal matter. It's a choice that the legislature would make, and then the voters would decide whether or not they agree with that.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Milks. Is there any other question or comment from the committee? Senator Hughes?
No, I'll just say that instead of now just a presiding officer being able to block it, it would spread it so multiple people could block it, actually, is what would happen, the various chairs and things. It's something to think about, though. Thank you.
All right. Any other comment or questions from the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been mulling over questions Senator Keel asked at our last meeting and mulling over my response a little bit. And his question was effectively, what's broken right now? What are we trying to fix? And I don't think that we're necessarily trying to fix anything in terms of policy or process. I think that what this resolution is aiming to address is something much larger, and that is trust. And the question is, do the residents of the state, do the voters of the state trust the legislature? And I think you could make a number of arguments in a lot of different areas that the legislature does not hold the trust of a lot of Alaskans right now. Just the fact that we've changed out nearly two-thirds of the legislature over the course of the last three elections would seem to indicate that to me. We've had a lot of unhappiness among the electorate, and I think that what this resolution is attempting to do is to address that trust and have the voters look at the legislature and say, if you're going to create a new tax, then we're going to have a final say on it. And yes, in theory, we can already do that with the referendum process. And we've seen that in terms of SB 21 back in 2014, as one example. But we also recognize that getting a referendum set up, or an initiative set up for that matter, is a lengthy and often very expensive process. And it makes you think that if we're not going to have this go to the people automatically, then the legislature would then have an incentive to tax the people that are least able to protest, in effect, in terms of time and ability to organize, or money to organize and create ad campaigns. And so by putting it onto the ballot automatically, it would it changes the calculus a little bit within this building. And I would say for the better. I know that's going to be a different answer among many of us, but I would say it changes the calculus for the better.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Hughes.
And I'll just add to this, because the initiative and referendum process is already there for the people initiating tax, or the people from ending a tax through the initiative and referendum process. So it doesn't restrain the people so much as it restrains the legislature, because the people could reverse something that a new tax the legislature might impose. So it's really a restraint on the legislature. Now, you could say, yes, the legislature could pass a tax and the referendum could end it, but but what I was thinking was the two-year delay. The legislature can undo something that the people do, but it has to wait 2 years, right? And so this would allow that to be sped up, that two-year period, right? Because they could initiate one, and we could do it immediately. So I guess the restraining is going back and forth, but I see it a little more heavily on the legislature end because, yeah. And I'm just wondering, I guess I do have another question before we wrap this up, Mr. Chair, is I seem to think, but maybe I'm remembering it incorrectly, that the previous one we did was on broad-based taxes for that Alaskans would pay, whereas this one would incorporate any kind of state tax on anything. Am I remembering that incorrectly?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, as the conversation continued through the course of the session, I think there was discussion about narrowing the language, but I don't believe that we ever actually narrowed it, though maybe your amendment did. I'd have to go back and look at the record.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Once again, with no further questions from the committee, we will now set SDR 7 aside. If members have amendments, please send them to my office by 2 p.m. Thursday, May 6. So 2 p.m. on Thursday, May 6. And thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Thank you, Mr. Milks. And now we will move on to Senate Joint Resolution 5, a proposed amendment to the constitutional spending limit by the governor. Caroline Schultz and Neil Steininger are once again available to provide answers on behalf of the administration. If y'all care to come up and take seats at the table. I believe you have follow-up from questions from the last session that weren't resolved. If y'all, if you please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, Neil Sanger, Director, Office of Management and Budget.
For the record, Caroline Schultz, Chief Policy Analyst for the Office of Management and Budget.
Thank you.
And in response to one of the questions asked on Friday, we produced another graph that I believe Mr. King is handing out to members right now. And I'll actually allow Ms. Schultz to address a little bit of the question. The question, just to refresh your memory, was about the current constitutional spending limit and setting its base at $2.5 billion. The prior graph that we showed was a little bit different than this. We've adjusted it to kind of be a little clearer about how that spending limit looked back in 1982. And I'll allow Ms. Schultz to talk a little bit about that.
Thank you. For the record, Caroline Schultz, Office Management and Budget. So a very simple explanation to Senator Hughes's question last week about whether or not voters believed that they were implementing a spending limit that was in fact lower than the current spending limit or spending levels. And the answer is quite simply no. And that's because of the simple provision that the current constitutional spending limit as written in Article 9, Section 16 excludes capital appropriations. So in this graph that we handed out, you can see that we did add two more lines on the graph that shows UGF agency operations in blue, and then UGF agency plus statewide items, and that's kind of what we consider our total operating budget. And if you look at those lines, you can see that they are well below the constitutional spending limit as it currently exists.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee regarding the graph we have in front of us right now? Seeing none, thank you so much. Were there any other questions that that y'all had prepared to answer? Nope. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate you bringing the issue back up for a little more in-depth discussion. I was interested in, and you know, I apologize that I had to jump out for part of the presentation the other day. In the thinking behind limiting the budget's growth to either population growth in Alaska or inflation in Alaska. It seems to me that if we get the results we want as a legislature, a growing economy, and it happens to coincide with a time when inflation which is something that the legislature can't control, is relatively high. It seems to me that that hamstrings the state of Alaska's ability to keep the party going, to meet the needs of an influx of population. Can you speak to why it wouldn't be some combination of the two?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the reason for picking the greater of inflation or population was really looking at our existing constitutional spending limit and the fact that the compounding of inflation and population together in the existing spending limit resulted in a spending limit that grows much, much faster than, you know, is reasonable or compared to the growth in the need and the desire for state services. So when you're looking at how to set your adjuster factor on a spending limit and what is, you know, proper, you want to make sure that it's not, you know, so great as to not be limiting at all, which the current compounding of the two, you know, appears to have done with our existing spending limit. But you also want it to be something that does, as you're leading to, does, you know, adjust and account for things that create pressure on state spending. So we know that both population and inflation can create pressure on the cost of providing government services, one through the demand with population growth, and the other really through the cost of providing those services. However, you know, compounding the two together isn't necessarily a, you know, a perfect analogy for the pressure on state spending. So that's why we chose the greater of the two. We didn't want to choose the lesser of the two or, you know, additive, but the greater of the two to ensure that should we see, you know, significant inflation or a significant jump in population, we're able to respond, but that doesn't create unconstrained growth.
Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate the impact of compounding. The existing limit compounds from a fixed reference year, though, right? And regardless of what the legislature actually spends, it rises. Why take the approach of the greater of one or the other factor when you are also changing from a fixed reference year to a three-year average of what we actually spent? Doesn't that accomplish what you just described, which is to prevent massive compounding but still allow the state to deal with the actual needs?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is a you know, pretty interesting idea to work into the math, is how that would work. One of the things on some of the graphs that we did prepare showed the difference with that no longer fixed base set in the past with the three-year average, showed the difference that is inherent there with the decisions you make as you approach spending in any given year. And there's a difference between whether you just continue to constrain spending, we showed it as based on our 10-year plan, or if you choose to maximize spending. And if you choose to maximize spending with that three-year average, you can still get to that unconstrained growth if you have the compounding factors, because it would allow you to continue to spend higher each year, thereby driving up your three-year average. So at that point, you still have the ability to have less constrained growth, even though it's not that fixed base in the past. So it's still a little more aligned to your actual spending because of the three-year average, but having the compounding would allow for that kind of expenditure maximization scenario that we showed on our graph to be a little less constrained. But it is, you know, that would assume a choice of a future legislatures and executive branches of trying to maximize expenditures. And I don't know that that's necessarily a, you know, a risk that's that high, but it is something to consider as you set up the calculation for a spending cap like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that that's a risk that's high, that's so high either, unless there's a genuine need and we're in a situation where Alaskans have some need for additional state services. I have questions on other topics. I don't want to dominate the beginning here.
We'll let Senator Myers wade into the water.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to return to a question I asked last time around. We were talking about the extra $1 billion we're getting from the feds this year and whether or not that qualified as money received from non-state source for a specific purpose. And effectively, you said that it did. And I can understand that. I'll let the lawyers debate that one. My question, though, is what kind of it has to do with what kind of incentive that creates for the legislature, because with that extra $1 billion coming in, effectively the question for the legislature with that money has been, do we use it to backfill our deficit in some way, or do we use it to spend on different programs? For example, the governor's talked about relief for the tourism businesses in the state. And then where do we draw the line between those two? Which direction do we go with it? Of course, they're not mutually exclusive, but it seems to me that if we find ourselves in a similar situation where we have some sort of unexpected windfall coming to us from outside of the state, it creates this sort of perverse incentive for the state to say, well, if we use it to backfill our deficit, then all of a sudden it actually effectively ends up lowering the spending cap. Whereas if we use it to because we haven't it effectively ends up lowering the spending cap because we haven't I'm afraid I'm at a little bit of a loss for words here, but because then we haven't bridged ourselves over. Whereas if we use it for new spending, and we have some other revenue to fill in that hole, whether we're talking about from the permanent fund or the CBR or something, then it just creates this very perverse incentive for the legislature to say that what is actually beneficial for us in the short term is not beneficial for us in the long term, and vice versa. And I get a little worried when we start putting those two at odds with each other. I'd just like to hear your response to that.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I think that is a pretty legitimate concern and question that we've been trying to think through. How does this spending cap, as written prior to, receiving pretty significant discretionary money in this regard, how would we cope with that type of situation? Because normally, in the normal course of the state budget, we do get some fairly discretionary federal revenues, but it's kind of a rounding error in the overall amount of federal revenues we receive. So it's not necessarily something that significant enough to take into consideration in putting together this calculation, but it's certainly, given that we're in having that experience right now, it's something to consider in how this gets put together. Right now, as written, it could, if used entirely to offset general fund expenditures, would result in that lowering of the three-year average. So mathematically, you're correct, it does create some perverse incentive in terms of how you make that allocation. And that's just something that needs to be considered in drafting a constitutional amendment like this.
Any follow-up, Senator Myers?
Not on this one, but I did have another topic. I'm happy to let somebody else on the committee go first before we delve into another one, but I think I'm good on this one for now.
Senator Hughes?
Yes, thank you. We learn from history. We learn from things that we do well. We learn from mistakes. So I'm not sure if what I may find here that might help me. Right now, it's just curiosity, because thankful the chart you did that talked about what happened back in '82 and looking at that, I'm curious, did they not do projections and realize it would be just climb so much that it wouldn't really constrain anything? Did they realize that, or did they just not do that back in 1982? Were the I don't want to impugn motives of anyone even back then, but were they like trying to look like they were doing something good, knowing that it would be just a pretty astronomical rate that would allow tremendous spending per capita. But the voters thought it was something good and it seemed like the right thing to do. I mean, what was the truth of how much this would shoot up? Was that known? And do you happen to know how the vote was? Was it extremely, was it a high percentage of voters that accepted it and very bipartisan? I'm just trying to see if there's any lesson we can learn, because it seems like it was not a very helpful constitutional amendment because of the situation we are in now. So do you have any background in the history of how that went, what I would say went wrong?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's a very good question. I don't know what the vote was. And I'm curious if Mr. Milks is still on, if he might have some knowledge of what the context of when that constitutional amendment was put together in the 80s, if there's any of that in the record.
And there he is. Mr. Milks, would you care to comment on this current topic?
Thank you. Chairman Bill Milks of the Department of Law, Assistant Attorney General. And I guess what I'd refer the committee to would be whenever there's a ballot, constitutional amendment before the voters, there's a ballot measure. And a pamphlet that's created and sent to all the voters. And we can certainly add that to the record here, but there you will see a description of what the amendment is. And actually, now I recall Senator Hughes asked me a question last Friday about what the voters have when they're approving an amendment. But that document, if you review it, you'll see there's a summary of what the constitutional amendment would do. Then there's and that's created by the Legislative Affairs Agency. Then there's a statement in favor of the amendment and a statement in opposition. And although I can't really paraphrase it right now, but what was all understood, that's the document that explains why some folks thought there should be an appropriation limit, and it was describing spending preceding this appropriation limit amendment going to the voters. So that is probably one of the best resource documents you could have to understand exactly what the facts were if the voters understood it. Mr. Chairman, if you wouldn't matter, I'd like to just clear up something Senator Hughes asked me the other day.
Please, go ahead.
Senator Hughes asked whether or not the entire constitutional amendment is on the ballot when people are in the voting booth. And the answer to that is no. An impartial summary of the amendment is what you see on the ballot. But in every voting place, the full amendment, all its language, is posted. And then a fuller document is mailed to everyone, which is this pamphlet that has the full language of the amendment, the neutral summary that's put together, as well as a statement in support and a statement in opposition.
Senator Hughes.
And just as follow-up, I'm going to have to assume, just based on what the election pamphlet said back in 1982, that, you know, concerned about overspending and more than the revenues, they must not have really had the information. And if the no was, you know, we don't know what might be ahead, we shouldn't have a cap, they apparently must not have had the projections and really mapped it out. I'm just going to have to assume that. And also, I was handed the vote was about 61% approval, 39% opposed. So it was overwhelmingly supported, and I'm just wondering, and I'm going to conclude that they didn't really look at the projections. And I have a second question, but it looks like there's hands up, so I can wait for the next round.
Well, I might take a turn at this, too. So my concern is some of these questions, I have a few notes here, and I'm concerned that it might just be a little, it might be something even for us to provide you the written questions and you to provide, you know, a written response on some of this. But let's try this one, okay? So one question is the constitutional budget reserve, does that become pretty much a non-issue once C and D are repealed and the cap is in place? And the only reason I ask this is because this might wind up, a suggestion would be to repeal all of Section 17 as an amendment and or just maintain the supermajority vote for access. But so the CBR is moot once C and D are repealed and the cap is in place, because the spending cap applies to all spending, including spending from the CBR. So the language in Section 3 could be unnecessary, and also the language in Section 2 could be unnecessary, as without Section C and D, there's no difference between money in the CBR and money in the general fund.
Chair Holland, that is a good question. I wouldn't necessarily say it's that the CBR, you know, no longer becomes relevant at all. It simply becomes a, you know, a constitutional rainy day reserve, effectively, that but still has access by a simple majority. Effectively, it would be saying that, you know, these certain revenues, as, you know, listed out in 17A, that those specific revenues to the state go into a rainy day account. And then that rainy day account is available for expenditure should, you know, other more normal revenues to the state be insufficient to meet, you know, the need of spending. So, you know, it's not made completely irrelevant, but it does sort of section off certain types of revenue and, you know, make those more of a formal rainy day account. You know, the Constitutional Budget Reserve right now does serve as our rainy day account, but with more stringent access provisions. This really simplifies the access provisions, but keeps that kind of formal general fund rainy day account sort of dividing line, if you will.
Is it along these lines?
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, talking about doing some of this in writing, I did a little bit in writing with Ms. Schultz over the weekend on this topic. What I'm concerned about with repealing sections C and D paragraph C and D of Section 17 there is we stop paying back our savings account. And, of course, we recognize that savings accounts are there to pull from if necessary, and we recognize that. But at the same time, a savings account at some point still needs to be paid back into. Just from my own experience, I had a period a few years ago where my income dropped by about half, and so I ended up using a lot of my savings account. But I also recognized that once I kind of attained some stability, I still needed to pay back into my savings account and build up my reserves again, because as much as you fall, you can, you know, lose your job completely and fall further. So I'm a little concerned that what's going to happen here if we repeal those sections requiring us to pay back the constitutional budget reserve, what will happen is we won't ever pay it back, and unless we end up with some sort of windfall again, you know, oil prices go up to $130 a barrel or something along these lines, and the end result will end up being that we hit another hard time, with what we have seen recently, it's possible to get a double whammy because we had low oil prices and then COVID hit. So we go into it with our reserves already drained. And without the requirement to start paying it back at some point, even though those two events might be 5-10 years apart, we could find our new happy medium, so to speak, and then not prepare for the next big event, and that very much concerns me.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, to kind of address a bit of that concern, there's, under our current revenue situation, under kind of current revenue projections, the ability to pay back the constitutional budget reserve is fairly constrained. We're not looking at future years with significant excess revenue in order to pay it back. That isn't necessarily a reason in and of itself to remove that repayment provision. But when you think about this in the context of the other structural changes of creating a ceiling, a true constrained ceiling on expenditures, in the event that we do have, you know, more revenues coming in, maybe revenue projections right now are wrong and we receive a windfall in the future, an expenditure cap will limit our ability to utilize that windfall or to spend away that windfall. We really would have to either save it or, you know, put it somewhere. And so we would have then more constrained options on what to do with, say, revenue surplus, and depositing that money into the Constitutional Budget Reserve as a state savings account would be one of those available places. And just from a kind of prudent finance perspective, if the Constitutional Budget Reserve becomes kind of a formalized rainy day savings account for revenue downturns, it would behoove us to deposit excess revenues in times of excess into the Constitutional Budget Reserve to know that it's there in the future for rainy days. However, depositing enough to build it back up to that, you know, $12 billion balance that it was at before we started drawing down, you know, that may not be the right amount of reserves that we need to have on hand once we resolve the other, you know, pieces of the fiscal problem that we're facing. The total amount of reserves that we need on hand is something that needs to be understood as we solve those other pieces. But it may or may not be that, you know, very, very large number we'd have to build back up to repay the entire debt. You know, ultimately, whether or not we erase that CBR debt is a policy call of the legislature through this constitutional amendment and a policy call of the people. But I think alongside all of the other pieces that we need for a fiscal plan, the notion of a CBR with that much money may not necessarily fit in that overall picture anymore.
I'll just say, Mr. Milks, correct or not, I kind of see when your screen is lit, you want to talk sometimes. That may not be correct. So I don't want to prompt you for information you don't want to offer. But had you anything to offer on this part of the conversation?
Chairman's bill. I'm sorry, no, I didn't have anything to offer. I just, I'll mute, put myself on mute, but I'll say.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Milks. All right. So, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess to hearken back to an earlier part of our conversation, I think the spending limit we have in the Constitution that this would amend was adopted in a period where I think over 8 years we had something like an average of 9% inflation a year, four of those years north of 11. So may have been somewhat different thoughts in the general public's mind. The question for the administration, though, has to do in part with this question about deleting the supermajority access to, and maybe not as much the repayment provisions of the CBR. Without a restricted access provision, it's difficult for me to understand how we call it a rainy day account. And I just, even as I look at the language here, I've already found a couple of ways that you can drain out more from the CBR than you need to fill a given year's budget account. It's not particularly tight. And if you can do that on a simple majority vote, how would the CBR function as anything other than the SBR, which we just acknowledged you get at with 21 and 11 and was the first thing drained?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the SBR did function, you know, similarly to this envisions the CBR functioning from a expenditure side. You know, a simple majority vote, rainy day account to go to when general fund revenues are low. That mechanism, an account to go to when revenues are too low to meet necessary expenditures, is something that the state needs access to. We need structurally some kind of rainy day account, whether that is, you know, the CBR in this case as it's drafted, or, you know, repopulation of the SBR, or, you know, as we sit right now, you know, without any change, it, you know, the ERA really is that next account. We need an account to go to when revenue is low, and this amendment would establish the CBR really as that account. Whether there's loopholes to get easier access to it than not, you know, be interesting to talk through what those loopholes are and ensure that they are ones that we actually want, or if they're just simply, you know, issues in drafting that need to be closed up. But the concept here is to ensure the state has a rainy day account with revenues dedicated to go into that rainy day account, so we know that in the future it will, you know, repopulate itself if it's used, and that we have that ability and that financial tool in future years.
And to
Senator Keel.
Thank you to that, Mr. Chairman. I did distribute, I have my staff give your office the ledge legal memo about the significant reduction in what would flow to the CBR by deleting the word directly. That remains a pretty significant concern. If we significantly reduce what flows to the CBR and make it easy to drain on a simple majority vote, I am not sold at this point on that functioning as a reserve account of any kind, rainy day or ordinary. So that's an issue. I had another question, Mr. Chairman, and that was to the exemptions and how they work, the unintended consequences of those. It's interesting to see the notion that all proceeds and repayments on general obligation debt would be added to the exemptions. And I think the administration has heard me talk before about the makeup of the packages and the proposed GO bond the administration put forward this year, consisting in an oversized part of ordinary capital appropriations that are necessary annual appropriations that we're just going to have to do all the time, but asking the voters to do those as GO debt and spread the cost over 20 years or so. It seems to me that as things get tight, this exemption really pushes us toward maximizing debt, maximizing use of borrowing. And I wondered if you had comment on why that's desirable.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it's not necessarily the concept of maximizing the use of borrowing, but more that general obligation debt, because it has to go to the voters, you know, we have to get public consent in order to incur that expenditure. So when we would put that to the voters, if it is something over and above what's available within the constitutional appropriation limit, you know, that is then going to the voters to approve that expenditure greater than the constitutional expenditure limit. And so that's why that's exempted. It gets the consent of the people through the ballot measure process inherent in general obligation bonds.
So I will chime in because I had a note on here about that, and a possible suggestion was seen as allowing spending above the limit only on capital projects and only in the same manner as issuing a general obligation bond. Would that be a way forward?
Chair Holland, that's certainly something to consider. When you look at the current constitutional spending limit, there's a lot of considerations of capital spending in that constitutional spending limit. In this draft, you know, all capital spending is under the cap. But that's certainly, you know, something to be considered as you look at the way this is drafted compared to the way the existing limit is drafted.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. Maybe I think I was here when this was very first presented, but it seems like a fundamental part of this presentation ought to be sort of where we sit at our starting point, with our economy, our population, how our spending on the operating budget compares to other states, even though we have unique challenges and provide services in communities that are provided locally in other states. That seems like it's a missing part to this presentation, and maybe I missed it. But I still would like that as some kind of documentation. I know there's been research on that. For instance, the number of state employees we have per capita, that kind of thing, where there's some room where we need to understand we're already starting at a rather high point. So I just wanted to ask if that's something you could provide. And then in tangent with that is also the case to be made that if you want a strong private sector, you don't want your public sector spending to correlate with that, really, because, I mean, as your economy grows and your population grows, yes, you may need a few more things here and there, but you don't want it at the identical rate, right? Because the government sector doesn't produce any wealth. It's anything that is supporting that government structure is coming from the private sectors, and so every dollar you drain off the private sector to help the public sector is a dollar that can't be used to grow the economy. So I just feel like that is something that needs to be part of this conversation, and the multiplier effect also of a dollar in the private sector is greater than the multiplier effect of a dollar in the private sector is higher than in the public sector. So that's just a little speech there. But I would love to have some documentation that would go along with this. And so my question now is a little bit different, but that's kind of the basis of it. And it's more appropriate, too, for judiciary because it has to do with legal matter. I've heard some say, oh, well, I'm okay. You know, if we want to fix the spending cap in statutes, but I don't want it in the Constitution. Well, could you speak, because I think it's good for everybody to know. I fundamentally know, and a lot of people that are engaged probably know, but is there value in putting a revised spending cap in the statutory, or do we really need to have it in the Constitution, and can you make the case why it should be in the Constitution as opposed to in statutes?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'll kind of lead in with an answer, but given that this kind of delves into the legal area, I'll probably give this question to Bill Milks. But generally speaking, the constitutional spending limit creates a hard constraint in the Constitution and truly cannot be exceeded. A statutory spending cap, you know, likely could be exceeded through an appropriation made by the legislature, simply because, generally speaking, you know, appropriations are, you know, kind of the more binding law. They kind of overcome other laws. But I can let Bill definitely can speak, or Mr. Milks can definitely speak a little more eloquently to that and, you know, the legal considerations behind, you know, why a statutory spending limit is less enforceable.
Okay. Follow up? I'm sorry. Mr. Milks?
Thank you, Chairman. Milks, Department of Law. I actually think Mr. Steininger eloquently addressed it and explained it. Constitutional spending cap or appropriation cap is basically binding. The statutory cap is important, but ultimately the legislature retains the power of appropriation, so it's not ultimately binding.
Just to follow up with that, Mr. Chair, as far as the case for this, is that dollars that swirl around or circulate within the state don't provide any growth. It's dollars coming from outside the state, and government dollars are usually the ones that swirl around within the state. It's the private sector dollars that can draw money in from outside, and that gives us a stronger economy, so I just will point that out. I will say probably the only value of a spending cap in the statutes would be that when the legislature exceeded it,
our constituents would beat us over the head. So that's about the only value that there would be. So at least my constituents would.
I have a comment, and this is getting on too. I believe you had a question about the savings account term in the last committee meeting, and what was the savings account current term. And so there was a concern that so the phrase savings account could be construed as overly broad, and a clever legislature could create another savings account with the idea that it's not subject to further appropriation and they could bypass the spending limit. Would it be a encouraged replacement to remove the word state savings account and identify in particular appropriations of the budget reserve fund or appropriations of state retirement trust funds, or just narrowing that down to something besides a state savings account? Excuse me.
Chair Holland, that would provide more, you know, specificity in the language, but the caution that I would give is it's hard to predict in the future the structure of the accounts that may fund future programs. And I'll give a bit of an example to kind of help make that point a little clearer. So take the Marine Highway System Fund, for example. The way that fund operates is that revenues from the Marine Highway System are deposited into that fund, and then that's appropriated from, and we count as spending when we appropriate from that account. And that's, you know, the normal operation. But every once in a while, that Marine Highway System Fund, say they have a bad revenue year or, you know, some other situation, we appropriate additional money into that account. And we don't count when we appropriate that money into the account that as the true spending necessarily under this guise. That would be a deposit into a savings account. And then we would count as spending, you know, when they use that dollar for service in a later year. And the reason that I use that example is because you may well envision a future where, you know, we have programs operating similarly, where there's, you know, revenues coming in, depositing into account, but occasionally you have a bad revenue year, you need to place money in that account. Do you count the spending for the purpose of an appropriation limit at both times, when you deposit into the account and when you spend out of the account? Or do you just count as spending when you spend out of the account on the actual service, when the dollar leaves the treasury? And listing out the accounts in the Constitution would then limit you in your ability to use that type of financial tool for future programs. And it would, you know, it would just create kind of a constraint that is not, that we don't intend in this draft, and that may not be intended by listing those accounts. You know, there's other accounts, just to give an example of kind of one where we would consider a deposit in to count to the expenditure cap. We have the vaccine assessment account. That's an account capitalized with monies paid to the state and money from the state for the bulk purchase of vaccines. When we put money into that account, we count it as spending, because that money in the account can be used at any time by the Department of Health and Social Services to make bulk purchases. And when they make those purchases, we don't actually count that as an expenditure at that time. We count the expenditure when we receive money to pool for bulk purchases. So there's kind of two different ways of addressing some of these accounts that it really, what it comes down to is, when do we count that dollar is being spent? When it's been committed to a specific purpose for which it can't be redirected is generally when we count as expended. So in the case of the vaccines, it has been committed to vaccines. We can't, you know, without, you know, a lot of work, remove money from that vaccine assessment account without spending it on a vaccine. But the Marine Highway System Fund account is available for general appropriation by the legislature. So when the money goes in, it's not being counted as spending yet, because you still have the authority to expend it elsewhere.
Thank you. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We might have different definitions of a whole lot of work to get money out of funds, since they're not dedicated, or even out of state corporations. Mr. Chairman, it's a it was a fascinating discussion earlier about sort of the economics, and it's going to shock you right to your toes to hear that I don't necessarily share Senator Hughes's view all the way around. I think that when Alaskans create businesses and do work, innovate, generate efficiency, all of those things create value, and they create economic growth. And so dollars circulating within Alaska, I very much disagree, with the notion that those are not of value in creating economic growth, and then only the outside dollar coming in creates economic growth. The other thing we're missing in that equation is that when the dollar goes out of Alaska and off to the shareholders in Houston or London, it doesn't do a whole lot for the economy here in the state. But, Mr. Chairman, I want to get back to the constitutional amendment proposal here, because that's a little bit the economic model that we have today. We don't have any connection between economic activity in Alaska and the resources the state has to support an economy, or very little. I guess that corporate income tax is something. And so if we maintain this model and we get into a situation of good economic growth, possibly population growth, you're going to see, as we discussed earlier, that need for additional state services. So one of the incentives, if I understand right here, it will be to devolve government services to other levels. Because if I understand the proposed amendment correctly, it's not really a limit, as Senator Hughes discussed, on total government. It's really just on what comes out of the state treasury. So if we were to say, boy, we really need $18 million of room, what we need to do is give second-class boroughs police powers and cut the entire trooper staff in the Fairbanks North Star Borough area. We could just do that. Shuffle that to the Fairbanks taxpayer, and have that headroom under the spending cap. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, you know, under the spending cap, if you needed to generate additional room to meet a need that you perceived as future legislature perceived as important, you know, as you're getting at, they would have to weigh that against other state expenditures and make a decision there. You know, whether that's a reduction in trooper force, a reduction in education spending, a reduction in, you know, anything else, you would have to weigh your various needs against each other within your cap. So it's by creating constraint, you're creating that limit on the growth of government. So when you add a new program, you would need to, you know, find room within the spending limit in order to add a new program. The intent of this is to limit the ability to add new programs and to, you know, create unconstrained growth on government that's difficult to wind down when revenues decline.
So I should have chosen Kenai, Mr. Chairman. I think they have fewer votes, but none of them are on the committee. So I guess not a cap on government, just on what the state does out of its current pocket. That's a bit of a concern.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Are there any other questions from the committee? I have just one more, and so I don't know if I'm going to phrase this quite right, which I'd like to have given to you in writing. But it's considered that the inflation adjustment in the bill is generous, and that the cumulative change in inflation over 3 years is about 7 to 9% allowable growth. And that number gets applied to the three-year average spending, which should normally be about 2 to 3% below the prior year spending. So, in other words, the current language allows the budget to grow by more than inflation. And shouldn't the cumulative growth factor be just 2 years instead of three?
Chair Holland, are you just suggesting what it would look like with a different, you know, kind of a different inflationary factor? I mean, that might be something, as you say, an answer in writing where we could show you a graph with a different inflationary factor to it might be something that we could work up with our current graphs and show you.
That's what I was holding out.
Show you
for
a picture of that. Yeah. might be harder to talk through when a picture would probably show that answer pretty well.
All right. All right. Well, are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, any other comments from the committee? Seeing none. So at this point, we're going to set SJR5 aside. Once again, if members have any amendments for SJR5, please send them to my office by 2 p.m. on Thursday, May 6th. And we'll see what that looks like. So is there any other business before the committee? Seeing no other business, our next meeting will be Wednesday, May 5th at 1:30 p.m. And today we are adjourned at 2:47 p.m.